And you'll recall we were in our Gemara dealing with what the Chevlei Mashiach will be like and whether one wants to be a part of them. So we're on Tzadi Ches Amad Beis, 98B, Tzadi Ches Amad Beis. And let me refresh your memory since we missed a week last week due to the wedding that I had. So the Gemara cites two opinions of Amoraim that wanted not to be present during Chevlei Mashiach. The Gemara then asks of a rabbi, why would you not want to be here? You're so full of Torah and Gemilas Chasadim that you will be unaffected by the trauma of the arrival of the Mashiach. And the Gemara's answer was based upon the story of Yaakov in the Parsha, Shema Yigrom HaChet. Although Rabba conceded that he had much Torah and Gemilas Chasadim, he was a great Gomel Chesed, he was a great learner of Torah. Nevertheless, he was afraid that he might sin and that would reduce his Zuhuyot, reduce his protection for the world to come, for the Chevlei Mashiach, and therefore, he did not want to be present. And that the Gemara's analogy is to Yaakov. The Torah says, as we learned 2 weeks ago, that Yaakov was very frightened when he came up to came to meet with Esav. And the Gemara asks, why was he so frightened? After all, Hashem had promised him that he would take care of him and guard him and protect him. And the Gemara's answer is, while Yaakov, of course, knew of that promise, nevertheless, he was afraid that he might have sinned and in the process of sinning would lose his protection from Esau. That's the Gemara we learned last week, and I wanted to just make a couple of comments about that Gemara before we proceed to fresh Gemara today. So first of all, the phrase Chevlei Mashiach is a very, very widespread one. I think probably all of us have heard of it, Chevlei Mashiach. What exactly is the meaning of that phrase? So I didn't mention it last week, but Rashi actually cites two interpretations, and I think it's worth looking at Rashi to get his interpretation, because it's such a phrase used so frequently. What exactly does it mean? So Rashi is, how shall I find it for you? I don't know if I can. It's about 20 lines from the top of Rashi, which is the commentary on the right-hand side, right margin of the Gemara. I'll just read it because there's no way for me to point it out to you. Chevlo shel Mashiach goralo, his lot. And the Maharshal adds goralo v'chelko. It's the Mashiach's portion. Chevlei Mashiach means the lot of the Mashiach, the portion of the Mashiach. That's kind of a different reading than most of us are accustomed to. Chevlei Mashiach, we usually interpret to mean the trauma, which I mentioned before, of the Messianic era. So what does it mean, the portion of the Mashiach? How do you understand that? What do you mean, the portion of the Mashiach? Why is that the chelek, as in the Marshal's reading, or the portion, or the goral, the lot, literally means the lot. A lot of the Mashiach. How do you understand that? Like, why? What is there about the Mashiach such that his portion or his lot will be full of such trauma? Why is that trauma identified as his lot or his portion? Any suggestions coming through on chat? I don't see anything, but I would, of course, welcome your suggestions. One thought that occurs to me is that all such radical transformations have as their lot or as their portion trauma. In other words, when something great and wonderful is about to happen in the world, it is often preceded by and surrounded by traumatic events. If you think, for example, of the French Revolution, there was a nasty time preceding a reign of terror preceding the French Revolution. Take the French Revolution to be a good thing, which most of us probably do. then there was a reign of terror prior to the revolution. If you think about, let's say, the emancipation of slaves, that great, and I think definitely positive transformation in American political and social and economic life was preceded by something as awful as the Civil War. And probably, I mean, we can think of many other examples from history where good things happened in the midst of terrible events. Another example might be, not everybody will make this connection, but I think it's not unreasonable to make. The Holocaust preceded the founding of the State of Israel. So one might argue that all great redemptive transformative events in history, in world history, in history in general, are preceded by, and therefore their lot is,
what's he talking about?
Negativity. So that's one way to read Rashi. I'd wonder, again, if you have any other readings, I'd be happy to hear them. But that's an interesting way of thinking about Hevelei Mashiach, that it is trauma is a necessary component of political transformation. Now, what's the second interpretation of Rashi? Lishna Achrina. The fright and the wounds that will be in the days of the arrival of Mashiach, which is the more usual translation, that there will be these frightening events, Mechemes Gog u'Magog, the way the Nevi'im described that, the war and splitting of the city and really apocalyptic transformations, terrible events that the Nevi'im described as being a part of the arrival, preceding the arrival of Mashiach. So that would be, chavalo means pachadim v'chavalim. Chaval here means wound. L'chabel is to wound somebody, to harm somebody. And Rashi adds the word pachad, which is anxiety or fear, and they kind of go together. So that's really the more standard reading of Hevelei Mashiach. Okay, so that's worth storing in your brain cells, these two different readings of Rashi of Hevelei Mashiach, a Chavalim, and the first one being, I think, the more novel and less widely known of the two, and both worth, I think, reflecting about. I wanted to ask you another question about the analogy between Yaakov Avinu and Rabbah. Yaakov Avinu was afraid of Esav. Why? Because although Hashem had promised that he would protect him, nevertheless, he was afraid that he had sinned. Rabbah was afraid of Hevelei Mashiach, even though he had ample Torah and Gemilas Chasadim to protect him. So the Gemara draws an analogy between the two, and obviously the Gemara thinks the analogy is a sound one, but I would like to question that analogy. Not the result of the product of the analogy, but the logic of the analogy. So think about this. What did Yaakov have such that he was afraid that he would lose it because he might have sinned? And what did Rabbah have such that he was afraid that he might suffer from the trauma of the Messianic era? Think about it. We're analyzing the Gemara as serious learners of Gemara. What's the difference between the two? Anybody want to respond to that question? Either by taking yourself off mute or by inserting it into chat. Oh, I see there are a whole bunch of chat questions. Yeah, okay, I see a lot of comments about what I said, reaffirming what I said. Joe Kornzad, Binyan Bayis Sheni was shortly after the Churban Bayis Rishon. Okay, wasn't so soon afterwards, but okay. In any case, here's my point. Nobody I see is leaping to my challenge, so I will leap to my own challenge. Yaakov had a promise that he would be protected. Rabbah had no promise that he would be protected. There was a tradition that somebody who has ample Torah and Gemilas Chasadim would be protected. But Hashem never came down to Rabbah, you know, called him on his cell phone and said, hey, Rabbah, you're fine, you're protected, I'm promising you, you're good. That never was the case. So you think Yaakov's position would be much firmer than Rabbah's, because Yaakov got this guarantee from Hashem that I will protect you. Whereas Rabbah got no such guarantee. There's just this tradition, nothing personal to him. I mean, Hashem makes a promise, you expect him to keep his promise. That's not the case with Rabbah. Now, another disanalogy between the two is how sure, how certain could Rabbah be that he had sufficient Torah and Gemilas Chasadim to protect him from Chevle Mashiach? Yes, we have a tradition that if somebody is learns Torah a lot and does lots of Gemilas Chesed, he will be protected from Chevle Mashiach. Okay, but how can Rabbah be so sure that he's reached the elevated bar necessary for that degree of protection? It's a little bit like the coronavirus vaccine. Okay, 95%. That's great. As long as you're not one of the 5%. So Rabbah may have had extremely elevated stature with respect to Torah and Gemilas Chasadim, but could he be so sure that the stature was at 100% level? Maybe he was at the 95% level. So I'm a little troubled by the analogy the Gemara draws, because I think that there are some differences. But nevertheless, I guess the argument would be something like the following. If Yaakov, who had a personal, individual promise from Hashem that I will protect you, could be afraid that things might go awry and he might have sinned, then all the more so, Rabbah would have that fear. In other words, it's not so much that the analogy is strict, it's more like a kal vachomer. If even Yaakov Avinu was afraid that maybe he sinned, and the personal promise Hashem made to him would no longer obtain, all the more so Rabbah, who had no personal promise, and he had no guarantee, in fact, that he had a sufficient level of Torah and Gemilas Chasadim for it to be protective, all the more so he should be afraid of Chet. So it's not so much an analogy on this reading, but really kind of a kal vachomer. And I hear that. And maybe that's the best way to read the Gemara. Okay, you can think about this, but let's continue with the Gemara. So we are up to Kidatanya, which is the first word in the line. It's about 15 to 20 lines from the top, and it's right next to the superscript Dalet. Kidatanya, and then there's a superscript Dalet. It's right opposite the Davar HaMaschil in Rashi Santer, just pretty much opposite that, if you see that. I don't know how else to point it out to you. Do you have it? Can you? The first word in the line is Kidatanya. It's about 15 plus lines down, right next to the superscript Dalet. Do you have it, everybody?
Isn't it? You're talking about Samech Ches Amud Aleph, correct?
No, I am Samech Ches Sadi Ches Amud Beis. 98B.
No wonder I got it wrong.
Okay. Well, now you'll get it right. Okay, Sadi Ches Amud Beis, Kidatanya. Okay, do you have the place? Kidatanya. The Gemara now brings another example of the fear of Chet. Ad Yavor Hashem, this is a pasuk from Oz Yashi, Ad Yavor Hashem, Ad Yavor Avzu Konisa. We read it every day in davening. Ad Yavor Hashem, the Gemara Darshan Zo Biar Rishona. This is a reference to the first passing into Eretz Yisrael of Yehoshua, Biyarishona, Yeshua's first, or the Jew's first entree into Eretz Yisrael, Ad Yavar Hashem, that's the first one. Ad Yavar Al-Mizuganisa, this is a prophetic revelation about a future Yavar Am, future passing of the Jewish people into Eretz Yisrael. Zo Biyashnia, this is a reference to the coming of the Jews back to Eretz Yisrael during the period of Ezra, under Persian rule. They allowed them to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. They lived in Babel and then moved back to Eretz Yisrael. So it's a reference to that Biyashnia. And more, so the way the Gemara darshans the Pasuk, there is a strict analogy between Biyarishona, Yehoshua's entree into the land, and Biyashnia, Ezra's entree into the land with their followers. So, based upon the drasha, so there's a strict analogy. The Gemara then asks the following question. If there is a, or the Gemara raises the following point. If there is a strict analogy, Emor Me'ata now say, Ru'uyim hayu Yisrael la'asos lahem neis b'biyashnia k'biyarishona. If the Pasuk draws such a strict analogy between first and second, then just like when Yehoshua came into Eretz Yisrael, it was done with all kinds of miracles, so too when Bnei Yisrael with Ezra came to Eretz Yisrael, that too would be with miracles as well. So, where were all the miracles? Sefer Ezra does not repeat any dramatic miracles about the return of Ezra and his followers to Eretz Yisrael. But there should be, because just like Yeshua came with miracles, Yericho and the whole thing, so to Bnei Yisrael, coming with Ezra should have had miracles, but there were no miracles. But the Pasuk draws a strict analogy, so why were there no miracles with Ezra? Where it says, Ela shegaram hachet. Bnei Yisrael sinned, and the Pasuk's promise that there would be this parallel between Biyarishona and Biyashnia, Yeshua and Ezra, was fractured by the sins that Bnei Yisrael had done, which is to say that you see that sins can undercut a biblical promise. In the first instance, the biblical promise, the Torah's promise was, not biblical promise, but the Torah's promise for Yaakov, as Hashem promised he would take care of him, he was afraid that wouldn't hold. And the same thing with respect to Ezra, there should have been miracles, didn't hold because they sinned. Got it? Is the logic there clear, I hope? Okay, good. So the question is, what were the sins in Ezra's time that precluded miracles? There should have been miracles because of the drasha and the pasuk Ad Yavar Hashem Amzukanisa. Ad Yavar Amzukanisa. Parallel between the two. So there should have been miracles. There were no miracles because there was a chet. Question. What was the sin in Ezra's time which prevented miracles guaranteed by the pasuk from actually transpiring? Any hypotheses as to what those sins might have been? Anybody want to make a suggestion? Who's that? Who's
speaking? I would say Stephen Mance.
Hi, Stephen.
Hi there, good to hear. Just based purely on practical intuition, if they were in Bavel and they were resistant to going back to Eretz Yisrael, they were probably already adopting foreign customs. And don't forget, they're living in Bavel, which is completely pagan. There's no monotheism other than Judaism at the time. So if they're choosing to live in Bavel, they're actively living in a place of Avodah Zarah, which we know led to the Talmud Bavli, so it wasn't a sinful choice, but that could be the sin. It wasn't intrinsically sinful to be in Bavel necessarily if you had a frum lifestyle, but maybe that was a sin of, that caused them to not get Eretz Yisrael through miracles, that the whole Am didn't go back.
Okay, that's an interesting suggestion, and it dovetails with what Eliana suggests in the chat, that there was intermarriage, and as a result of intermarriage, they were not zochet to the miracles. Now,
and by the way, I would just say, oh, sorry, one other thing. Sorry. Just since when we had the Beis HaMikdash, we sinned and we were not a utopia. Kal v'chomer, before we had the Beis HaMikdash, we certainly sinned. We know what we sinned with the second Beis HaMikdash. It's right there in history. The Pharisees and the Sadducees were killing each other. So yeah. Since we know that, right on the pages of history, probably before we had the Beis HaMikdash, something similar was going on. That's my other thought.
Okay, I don't know. We, no evidence for that, although it's definitely an interesting conjecture. So certainly B'nai Yisrael were sinful. Of course, B'nai Yisrael were pretty sinful in Mitzrayim too. And nevertheless, they got into Eretz Yisrael. So the argument of intermarriage in and of itself, or the sinfulness of the Jews in Bavel, well, look, I mean, after all, Ezra, they left it. You know, they made Aliyah, they moved to Israel. And the Jews leaving Mitzrayim, they had sunk to Memtesh Sharei Tumah. So you might say, well, this is a different generation, which is possible. Maybe this generation was a lot better than the previous generation, whereas that wasn't the case with those who went to Eretz Yisrael. So that's definitely an interesting suggestion. The Marsha, in his commentary, makes this suggestion, which is also quite interesting. He says that the very fact that so few Jews made Aliyah and so many remained in Bavel was in itself a sin. Only a relatively small number of people went up to Israel with Ezra. Many stayed behind with their intermarried families, wives and families, which is a point that Eliana made. And the very fact that so few chose to make Aliyah wasn't itself the kind of chet that prevented miracles from happening, because it wasn't Barov Am Hadras Melech. It wasn't with a large group of people like the case of Yeshua. Everybody then went to Israel, unlike Ezra. So Ezra's Aliyah, his movement was a flawed movement. It was not able to liberate B'nai Yisrael in toto, which is, I think, an interesting suggestion. I'd like to share another reading, which is really innovative and extremely provocative. And I'd like to know what you think about it. This is very, very provocative and unusual reading. The reading is not mine. If it were, I wouldn't give it such an introduction. It's the Meshech Chachma from Meir Simcha Midvinsk, the brilliant, brilliant Tanil Chacham, or the Perish Al Torah, or Sefer on the Rambam. Brilliant, brilliant thinker. And he makes a claim which is, on the face of it, I would think, but the opposite of what we would expect. He says, compare and contrast the religious lives of Jews in Mitzrayim. Remember, Yeshua is the redeemer of the Jews from Mitzrayim who finally made it to Israel, children. And the lives of the Jews that were living in Bavel and then moved, those who did, from Bavel with Ezra to Eretz Israel. So what he says is as follows. The Jews who lived in Eretz Yisrael, in Mitzrayim, were pagans. As I said, they had sunk to Memtesh Sharei Tumah. They had really abandoned their core belief in Hashem. But they did preserve something. What did they preserve famously, even if they had adopted the pagan beliefs and practices of their Egyptian masters? What did they preserve? Everybody remembers?
Their names. Yes.
Very good. Howard types in Hebrew. Is that you, Howard, in Hebrew? That's impressive. Shloshinu Mabusham Lashonam Ushmam. They didn't change their dress, their language, and their names.
Yeah.
Okay, very famous teaching. Now contrast that with the Jews living in Bavel. They basically remained believers in Hashem. However, those practices that prevented assimilation, they didn't follow because they intermarried. And so here is the kind of you might say, almost topsy-turvy logic of the Meshech Chachma. He says, it's much better, listen to this, it's much better to abandon belief in Hashem, but nevertheless keep those practices that separate us from the surrounding population, like our names, our dress, and our clothing, our dress, and our language, than it is to abandon what keeps us separate from our environment and keep the basic beliefs and practices of the Torah. Let me repeat that, because it is just seems like it's the exact opposite of what we'd expect. If I were to ask you, had you not heard the Meshech Chachma, which is worse, to abandon belief in Hashem but to keep your Jewish name, your Hebrew name, or to keep your Hebrew name but abandon all belief in Hashem, what wouldn't you say? Oh, well, it's much more important to believe in Hashem. Okay, so I kept my this superficial, my name, my language, but I, you know, person believes in, you know, believes in ISIS. Wrong God, wrong belief, terrible. I would have said that that's much worse, because they abandoned the basic core of Judaism, believing in Hashem. Whereas in Bavel, they believed in Hashem. Okay, so they intermarried, bad thing. Intermarriage is bad, but at least they kept their beliefs and their belief in Hashem. If you were to compare the two, would you not say that those who lived in Bavel were infinitely superior, having kept their basic beliefs in Shmiras HaMitzvos in Hashem, and basic beliefs in Hashem and Shmiras HaMitzvos, versus the Jews in Mitzrayim who had abandoned their beliefs? Wouldn't you have said that the Jews in Mitzrayim are much, much worse? That's the opposite of what the Meshech HaChachma says. His argument is, if we can keep what makes us, what separates us from the nations of the world, over the long haul, we are better off than even if we retain those beliefs, but we erode what keeps us apart from our host culture. Because he doesn't quite say this, but I think this is what he means. So let's look at the first generation. First generation, in each case, first generation Mitzrayim, okay, lost belief in Hashem, kept their distinctiveness, eventually they recovered their belief. But if you're in a host culture, even if first generation keeps its belief in Hashem, but if they're assimilating into the larger environment, then second, third, and fourth generation, they're no longer Cohens, they're Cowens. In other words, they become completely lost for the long haul. It's better to keep a superficial distinction seriously than it is to keep a deep distinction without the superficialities that hold in place. That's the Meshech HaChachma's argument. Do you hear me? It's really quite surprising. What do you think of that argument? So I see somebody saying, somebody scroll above Eliana's comment. Rebecca, let me just scroll up here. I see somebody made a comment about the Yiddishists. Yes. A lot of interesting comments here. Leah Bennett, they're keeping their ethnic identity harder to assimilate if you abandon your life. Right. So you're keeping your ethnic identity, and that preserves you. And Michael, correctly, this is Michael Klein, I guess. I don't see everybody on the screen because for some reason I'm all featured here. Let me get the gallery view. There we go. I guess it's Michael Klein who says the secular Yiddishists in America haven't fared too well in terms of assimilation. That is very, very true. I'll give you an example from my own family. I have cousins who were not religious, and in fact they were really real Yiddishists, and their son did not have a bar mitzvah. He had a menschverin. Who knows what menschverin means? Menschverin in Yiddish means becoming a man. God forbid that you'd have a bar mitzvah. Bar mitzvah means it is a mitzvah, which you think is important. But if you're a secular Yiddishist, which they were, there's no such thing as a mitzvah. So he had a menschwerin. And the trajectory of that family was not a good one from the Jewish perspective. It didn't end well Jewishly. Whereas those people who insisted on keeping their differences, didn't intermarry, try to keep apart, kept certain qualities that were really distinctive to them, then even if they didn't have the same level of belief, but if they succeeded in keeping their kids loyal to what it is to be a Jew, it was more likely to last through the generations. That's the Beis HaChachma's argument. Eliana says a lot of Jews in the United States would faint if they were asked to keep their Hebrew name, language, address. Yeah, certainly the Jews who are secular Jews, Hasidim, as Eliana points out, certainly dress distinctively, and that's the reason for their distinctive dress, to keep themselves separate so that they don't fall into this assimilation. And Haredi Jews in general dress somewhat differently from everybody else. And the argument is, if you dress like everybody else, then you may become like everybody else. And even if your beliefs are firm, but if the superficialities erode, this is the Meshech Chacham's argument, the superficialities erode, then over the generations, it may not fare well. Now, I'm not so sure myself about that claim, because let's look at the fate of ethnic Jews. The Jews who went to, Grossinger's and the Tummler's and Yiddish, and they had bagels and lox and whatever it is that, and their kids may have had Yiddish names, but they also had English names. And it's not so clear to me how long that lasted. In other words, without deep convictions about the importance of Hashem in our lives, it's not so clear to me how long these superficialities would last. According to Chazal, they lasted in the Mitzrayim for centuries. But nevertheless, you had Moshe Rabbeinu who kind of made a difference. We need a Moshe Rabbeinu to revive that dormant Yiddishkeit. But remember that they were separate by virtue of being slaves. It wasn't like they were accepted. It wasn't like in contemporary American culture, President-elect Biden's three kids were married to Jews. Current President Trump's daughter married a Jew. The daughter of the Clintons married a Jew. So that's obviously bad. Intermarriage and assimilation is a bad thing, but it reflects our acceptance into our host culture. Whereas in Mitzrayim, obviously, we weren't accepted into our host culture. We were thoroughly enslaved. So that's the Meshech HaChachma's claim. And he's speaking, I think, out of his own experiences. He was living in the early 20th century, and he saw the threat of assimilation and emancipation and how Jews left the ghetto and how they, and he was very concerned about that. And he seemed to have had this conviction about the value of superficialities in preserving Jewish identity. You know, if we look at it from the longer sweep of Jewish history, I'm not totally convinced that his really provocative and novel analysis is correct, but that's his reading of this Gemara. Any other thoughts about that? Yes, Howard? You're on mute.
You wanted to say?
Yes, I want to say something. I think that Jews in general became more observant after the Holocaust. That changed so much. And of course, when Israel became Israel, our country. But I saw that myself. I saw it growing up post-war. And there were more schools. There were more yeshivas. There were also the day schools. My parents were teachers in the Workman Circle schools. And Zionism was not accepted by some of those people. But in our family, my father had been one of the early Chalutzim, escaping from Siberia. So he knew what it all meant.
And but your parents were exceptions because yes, they weren't just Yiddishists. They had tradition also. Yes,
and my grandfather.
There certainly was a strain in the Yiddish schools yes. too.
That's not secular Yiddishkeit. That's something.
Right.
In the Yiddish schools, they stress Zionism.
More traditional than most.
They stress
I think it's true that after the Holocaust, religious life in America received an injection of vitality, but that's because religious survivors came to this country, Hasidim and others, and they maintained their traditions, and then they injected life in this country with a whole new vitality and deep commitment. But yes, that's certainly what happened in this country after the Holocaust had a huge impact. Howard, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, what I mentioned before, by Rifkin compared why the continuity of a Jewish people had to be through Yaakov and not Esav. Is that Esav wanted Jewish themes, so his wife's names, where they weren't Jewish, but he gave them Jewish names. So Esav was an identity Jew, where Yaakov was a continuity Jew. So it's about continuity. So what we discussed now, we can discuss whether the Mitzrayim of not changing things is about continuity, but he basically said that the legacy and continuity of tradition for Judaism has to do with aspects that will lead to continuity, and that identity itself wouldn't be enough to transmit.
Right, which is very different from the Meshech Chachma's argument, and I have great sympathy with that difference. All right, let's continue with our Gemara. But certainly raises...
Rabbi, just real quick, two things. A, Trump, Kushner married a Trump who was Jewish, so it wasn't, that was not intermarriage, and we're being very Ashkenormative and not looking at the Sephardic side, where after the Spanish expulsion, a lot of these people were conversos, but they kept certain things that allowed them to remember that they were Jewish. And there, it seems amongst the Sephardim and Edom Mizrach, there's much more tradition. Based things going on with just keeping some sort of tradition and not necessarily keeping all of the things that go along with halachic Judaism.
Okay, thank you, Saul, for both of those comments, and I'll respond to each. I never said that Trump's son-in-law intermarried. What I said was that President Trump's son-in-law is Jewish. That's true. I didn't say that he married a non-Jew. He married a person who converted. But I phrased what I put what I said very carefully, and that's it. She didn't used to be Jewish, and she converted to Judaism in the context of that relationship. So it just goes to show you that somebody from far removed from Judaism could convert and marry a Jew. So I think my point is still correct, although I hear what you're saying. As far as the Sephardim and their traditionalism, that's a very interesting point. And my impression is the following, and those who maybe have more firsthand experience and know more about this might want to correct me, although maybe not. My impression is that the less than perfectly halachic Sephardim in this country, in the United States or in Israel, are traditional, even if they're not purely halachic, but many of them maintain a kind of basic belief in Hashem, as they're not, my impression is that they're not secularist. They have a kind of an amunah pshuta, kind of a basic belief that God runs the world, and they keep certain traditions even if they're not fully halachic. I think maybe to my sense is that is a more accurate characterization of the non-halachic or less than perfectly halachic Sephardi mentality, both in Israel and in the United States. Maybe I'm stereotyping, but that's my impression. And if that's the case, and they really are very different from what we're describing, they have this kind of powerful emunah in Hashem, even if it's not manifest in all the various details of the halacha that would be required. And that makes, you know, their continuity, I would say, even more likely to endure, even if they're not fully halachic. The question of the Muranos is really an interesting point. And the vast majority of Muranos, I think the majority were lost to Judaism.
Yeah.
But there were some who decades later, came back when they were able to, or it came back when they, as soon as they were able to. So they reconverted. And some, it took, you know, there are these stories of like people in Portugal all of a sudden rediscovering their Jewish roots, or Brazil or places like that. And
Quranic is a slur.
Yes, it is. It's, converso is really the correct term that is currently used. Quranic is a word which means pig, so it's a terrible word. Converso is now the more common phrase used in academic and, I guess, general Jewish circles. And some of them reconversoed, you know, they reconverted back. So, but the majority were lost. And that was one, it's one of the great tragedies of Jewish history, one of the great, great tragedies, princely people. In any case, that's, let's see if we can get a little bit more further in our Gemara. B'chein Amar Rabbi Yochanan. Okay, so we're continuing in Gemara, see if you can find the place. B'chein Amar Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan affirmed the same teaching as Rabba. Yaisi v'lo achmine, let him come, and I don't want to see him. So he was of the same school. So one of the Mefarshim, I can't remember who now, but one of the Mefarshim asked a very interesting and poignant question about this. What do we know about Rabbi Yochanan's personal life? Anybody recollect something relevant about Rabbi Yochanan's personal life? He lost 10 sons. He had 10 children and they all died, which is a fate unimaginable in its awfulness. And he used to carry around one bone of his youngest son, the last son who died, to, he says, he used to carry it around to comfort people who were suffering great loss. So Rabbi Yochanan was a person who was acclimated to tragedy. If he was acclimated to tragedy, couldn't he deal with Chevle Mashiach? He was used to living a terrible life. So why did Rabbi Yochanan, of all people, say that he didn't want to be present? Too terrible. Your life was really terrible, as it was. So why was Rabbi Yochanan so perturbed about being present?
Enough is enough. That's
an interesting question. What's that?
Enough is enough. They go through it in the next world also.
Okay, I hear that. Maybe. Interesting suggestion. Any other thoughts about this? So the explanation I saw by the person who, I don't remember who asked the question, but his answer is an interesting one, which is, it wasn't that Rabbi Yochanan was troubled by the pain he would go through. He was troubled by the Chil Hashem involved in this terrible war in which Jews would die as well as non-Jews. And the whole thing, the whole idea of Chevle Mashiach, in which there would be a breakdown in society and civilization. It wasn't his personal pain. He could deal with that. He had plenty of experience with that. But the Chil Hashem of seeing so many Jews die and the breakdown in society and civilization, that was something that he found difficult to bear. Interesting way of thinking about it. But let's continue with the Gemara. Amalei Reish Lakish. Reish Lakish asked Rabbi Yochanan the following question. Reish Lakish is his primary interlocutor and interrogator. He always asked Rabbi Yochanan and his Rebbe questions. My Taima, what are you afraid of? Now, this is really very, folks, this is really interesting comment he makes. So listen carefully and see what the comment is and the response, more the response. This is a quotation from a pasuk in Amos, which is referring to the Gemara and stanza to the Messianic era. Just as a person runs away from a lion, upigaod hadov, and as running away from a lion, he gets attacked by a bear. Finally, uba bias, he makes it into the house after escaping this vicious bear. The Samach Yado al Akir, and he gets into the house and puts his hand on the wall just to rest. Unishacho Nachash, and he's bitten by a snake. That is a description of the Messianic era. You'll go from people will go from terror to terror to terror, chased by a lion, then by a bear, and then finally get into the house. You think you're safe, put your hand on the wall, bitten by a snake. So Rishlanka says the following. Bova arech dugmaso ba'olam hazeh. I will show you an exact analog to the fate of human beings in the world to come, Yimasa Mashiach, in the world in which we live. You think that's so bad? Look at our lives. And he says as follows. Bizman sha'adam yosei l'sada. Somebody goes out to his field to check his crop. Upaga bosanter. He meets a government official who's measuring the fields and will no doubt rip him off and make his field small so that the government can get more property. Okay? Doma kamisha pagabo ari. It's as if he bumped into a lion. Nicknesslier, oh, okay, I'm going back to my, this is bad in the fields. The government official is going to rip me off. Let me go back to the city. Nicknesslier, pagabo gabai. Who did you bump into? The tax collector. You think it was so good in the fields? He bumps into the tax collector. Doma kamisha pagao dove. It's as if he bumped into a bear. Bear tried to eat him up. Finally, nichnas lebeso, he goes into his house. And he finds his sons and daughters stricken with starvation. Doma kamisha neshacho nachash. It's as if he was bitten by a snake. So what's your argument, Rabbi Yochanan, that things will be so terrible below some Mashiach? Look how miserable our world is. Think it's any better here? Isn't that an interesting argument? How would you apply it, by the way, to contemporary times? So I certainly identify with the tax collector. I can tell you that in current day living in New York, if you drive down Ocean Parkway at 36 miles an hour from the beginning of Ocean Parkway to the end of Ocean Parkway, you will end up with 7 tickets. Because there are these traffic, you know, there's speed cameras. And if you go 36 miles an hour by accident, like you were cruising along at 33 or whatever, that sounds kosher, and you went a little too fast. A friend of mine told me that his wife was totally unfamiliar, or his cousin, was totally unfamiliar with Ocean Park, was visiting Brooklyn the first time. And she didn't realize this, and she got like a string of 5 tickets just going down Ocean Parkway. So that to me is like, you know, the meeting the tax collector. You know, you kind of can't escape. And then, of course, you do alternate side of the street parking, and, you know, you're 2 minutes late, and boom, you've got a ticket. Or, what's even more annoying, fortunately, when it comes to alternate side of the street parking in certain residential areas, you can double park. Woe unto the person whose double parking lasts a minute into when you can no longer double park. If you come out of your apartment a minute or two late, boom, you've got a huge ticket. So living in New York is not the easiest thing to do, forgetting about the challenges of subways or whatever. Once upon a time, people traveled on subways. Now that seems very far removed from us. However, we should return to it soon. But, you know, there is disease, coronavirus lurking around. It's not like our world is so smooth and clean. And Rishlakish has a very cynical view of what life is like. Now, of course, maybe he's partially reflecting Rabbi Yochanan's life, which was really awful. But I find this to be a little comic. It's funny almost. I mean, it's sad, but it's almost a little comic. Like, look how bad our life is. It's as if, you know, this is kind of like a little skit on Saturday Night Live or something. It's like, you know, it's like, look, go from here to here to here. This happens. Look at all the bad things that happen. Look at the terrible world in which we live. I just find it to be, I guess, tragicomic would be maybe the best word to use to describe it. And Rish Lakish has a very, very negative view of the world. I don't know. What do you think? that a little too negative? Maybe he's trying to use this extreme, almost comic negativity to persuade Rabbi Yochanan that he needs to change his tune and look forward, look towards the Mashiach. Maybe it was a rhetorical strategy to shake Rabbi Yochanan up. I mean, it does seem like a very dour view of the world. I don't know that Reish Lakish and Rabbi Yochanan, Yochanan started out in extreme poverty. When he became the Rosh Yeshiva, he acquired considerable wealth because in those days, Rosh Yeshiva were not poorly paid. Somebody became head of yeshiva. He was elevated by the community and he received significant support. His children weren't dying of starvation. They died, but not of starvation. So I'm not sure. I don't know that Reish Lakish, they were brothers.